both about this interpretation, and it's still being discussed today. In fact, anybody who's interested in foundations will have had very, very long, never-ending conversations about the many worlds interpretation. It'll probably happen to you at some point. So let's try to put it in the context of the measurement problem that we discussed on the first day. So remember the postulates from textbook quantum mechanics. The problem was the inconsistency between the deterministic evolution postulated for the evolution of isolated systems and the indeterministic evolution you see in measurements. Also, the discontinuity in the evolution through measurements and the continuity of unitary evolution. So the way many worlds and the Everett interpretation try to solve this problem is by denying these two postulates here. So according to this interpretation, the quantum state is a complete description of reality, and it always evolves deterministically and continuously. And that's all that happens. So you have some universal quantum state evolving in this way, and there are no changes in the quantum state of this sort. And measurements are just another kind of interaction between systems modeled unitarily. That's it. So the obvious question is, well, how is this going to solve the measurement problem? So remember, if we have our Stern-Gerlach apparatus, and the apparatus is set up so that if you were to feed in a Z-spin up state, the apparatus would indicate up. And if you feed in a Z-spin down, it indicates down. Then if you feed in a coherent superposition of the two states, the apparatus becomes entangled with the spin. And you could say, well, this is a state that is not an eigenstate of the projectron to this guy or the projectron to this guy. Therefore, it doesn't have the property of indicating up or indicating down by the standard way of assigning properties, by saying that, you know, something's only got a property if it's an eigenstate of that observable. We saw last lecture that the collapse theorists were motivated to say that there's a new dynamics that takes this to one term or the other quite reliably. Because if you let this thing persist for too long, it would be something that we don't experience. You know, we don't see states like this in the lab because this would correspond to something weird that we hadn't seen before. Apparatus indicates up, superposed with apparatus indicates down. What could that possibly look like? Or cat alive plus cat dead. Clearly, we have to eliminate those because, you know, they're strange. But the Everettian takes a different approach. He says, well, let's explore what an observer would see if we treat that observer as just another collection of atoms interacting in the standard way with the system. So here's my observer over on the right. And I imagine that she starts out in some state ready to observe. So again, the idea here is that this might be a very complicated state. But by assumption, the theory says, look, there is some state in a large Hilbert space that describes the physical state of the observer. So I just denote it as follows. And whatever it is, if it's going to be a good observer, then it ought to be the case that if the apparatus indicates up, for example, then so suppose we just had a term that was spin up, apparatus comes to indicate up, then the observer should also believe that the apparatus indicates up. So the observer should go into some appropriate state. So I haven't written out explicitly what the evolution would look like if I just had spin up. But imagine that. So I just have spin up, then the final state would just be this term here. And if I had just spin down, then the final state would be this term here. So that's, you could say, what it is to be a good observer, to be able to reliably tell the difference between, you know, what the apparatus indicated. And you would say, well, for those cases, there's no problem, right? There's a definite state of the observer, has properties. But now, if I prepare this coherent superposition, then the observer gets entangled with the apparatus and the spin. So the observer is now combined into this funny entangled state. But note that that's not quite the same as the observer seeing something weird. Because suppose you imagined asking the observer, you know, are you seeing something definite or something very strange? Then you could ask, well, what would happen if the spin were up? What would the observer report? Well, in that case, we would just have this term. The observer would report, yeah, I'm seeing something very definite. It's not weird at all. It's just, you know, a definite outcome. Similarly, if the spin were down, the observer would also report, I'm seeing something definite. So what happens is that if you ask the observer that question, the observer goes into this entangled state. But in both branches, the observer would say, I'm seeing something completely definite. It's not weird at all. Okay? So there's no sense in which there's a part of the observer that's sort of looking down on this state and saying, how odd. If you really analyze it, you say, oh, no, now the observer's in this funny superposition of thinking that there's some definite outcome in both branches. So that's interesting. Let me point out something else about observers. Suppose you have many different observers. So here I've chosen two. And they both start out ready to observe. And you imagine the same sorts of things, that they're both reliable observers, so that the first observer will always come to recognize what the apparatus is indicating, and similarly the second observer. So in this branch, if the spin had been up, the observers would agree that it's up. And if the spin had been down, the observers would agree it's down. And then by linearity, if the spin is in a superposition, then the final state is a superposition of two ways in which the observers could agree. There's no branch wherein the observers are going to disagree. So again, we can use linearity to see that it's not as if we're going to have different observers thinking different things about what the outcome of the experiment was. So again, in each branch, there's going to be intersubjective agreement about the outcome. So here's Everett's proposal for how to make sense of this. He says, we shall deduce the probabilistic assertions of the collapse postulate. So this is the one that he wants to eliminate from the axioms. So we'll re-derive the probabilistic assertions as subjective appearances to such observers, thus placing the theory in correspondence with experience. We are then led to the novel situation in which the formal theory is objectively continuous and causal, while subjectively discontinuous and probabilistic. So he wants to say that those two axioms we saw, only one of them makes a statement about what's objectively occurring. The other one is just making claims about what particular observers will see subjectively. So if you read Everett's paper on this, he uses the term relative state a lot. So the kind of language that he uses is as follows. He says, neither the system nor the observer has a state of its own. Okay, so when we have this funny entangled state, the system and the observer don't have a state of their own. However, you can say that spin up is the state of the system relative to the observer being in the state observing up. And spin down is the state of the system relative to another state of the observer. So he says that the quantum jumps, collapses, for example, exist in our theory as relative phenomena, i.e. the states of an object system relative to chosen observer state shows this effect, while the absolute state changes quite continuously. So again, he's saying the discontinuity and the indeterminism is just a feature of states relative to a particular observer. So let's talk a bit about the problems that this kind of approach faces. To do that, I'm going to have to adopt a shorthand. So rather than writing down states like this all the time, I'm just going to write it down like this. So R is going to indicate a ready state for apparatus and observer. F plus and F minus are going to be the states wherein the apparatus indicates up and the observer recognizes that it indicates up, F minus for down, just so that I can write out some nice equations. So here's the first problem. It's called the preferred basis problem. Everett wants to claim that if I evolve to a state like this one, then I should interpret the system as being in the state plus relative to the observer being in the state F plus. But there's other ways of writing this entangled state. I could decompose it relative to a different basis for the observer. So rather than writing out in terms of F plus and F minus, I could write it as an entangled state where now this state is F plus coherently superposed with F minus. Here it's the same coherent superposition but with the opposite phase. So if I take the inner product of this state with this guy, I'll collapse the system state to this. And if I take the inner product of him with him, I'll get this state. These guys are not orthogonal, but that's okay. I can still imagine rewriting the total state as this sum. The two terms in the sum are orthogonal by virtue of the orthogonality of the second piece. So this is just another way of writing the state. And why can't I say now that this is the state of the system relative to this state of the observer? This is a funny state of the observer because it's a coherent superposition of observing different things. But why shouldn't the interpretation be according to these branches? So rather than saying that objectively I have this and subjectively I have this or this, why not say that, you know, subjectively we're here or here, and that doesn't seem to recover our experiences because you know, these two options don't correspond to seeing spin up and seeing spin down. So any thoughts on how to solve the preferred basis problem?
Yes. Why doesn't this just respond to have a different apparatus where you're just measuring the x instead of z or something?
Well, because we're imagining that the unitary that couples the spin to the apparatus and the apparatus to the observer is fixed. That's given. And so this is definitely a measurement of z-spin. That's what has occurred. And now we're asking about different ways that we can write that final state as a superposition of two states. So there's no question that a z-measurement has occurred. And it's not as if I can rewrite this in a way that, you know, the interpretation would be really an x-measurement has occurred. This is not an eigenstate of the observable corresponding to the apparatus and observer having measured z spin up. Because although for a qubit, you know, a superposition of z up and z down is equal to x up, for an apparatus, a superposition of indicating z up and indicating z down is not equal to indicating x up. It's very different, right? So for example, you know, if I imagined you know, the pointer of my observer going to one spot or another, the superposition is going to have this, you know, coherent superposition between two pointers, as opposed to some other configuration where the magnets were oriented like this and the pointer came out just one way. They're extremely different states. Yes. Yes, you could. You could try to make an argument with decoherence. What kind of argument would you make?
The two states for the seed, for the measurement device and the observer are so large that they become effectively orthogonal.
So we are assuming that they're orthogonal. F plus and F minus are orthogonal. But that doesn't change the fact that I can write it in this basis. So it's not their mere orthogonality that's significant here.
So if you're going to go with a decoherence idea, then yeah, you have to couple to it the environment.
Yes.
And the environment is going to somehow make the first, you know, decomposition. I mean, it's basically doing all this observation on this plus and minus basis, right? And maybe, there would be some way out. So I don't know where to go from there.
Well, you're both on the right track. Suppose you do couple to some environment. So I'll just say the initial state of the environment is E naught. Then what you get typically is that the environment goes into one of two orthogonal states, depending on what the state of the apparatus is. So your final state is going to be now this entangled state among these three systems. And what decoherence is, if I look at the reduced density operator for the system, so in this case, let's take the spin and the apparatus. So if I look at the reduced density operator for that pair, because of the rapid decoherence, very quickly, you lose the off-diagonal elements in that reduced density operator. So it just becomes an incoherent mixture of this guy and this guy. Whereas early, it had these cross terms between this and this. So decoherence makes you lose those cross terms quickly. And what it means is that it's very hard to see the coherence between these two guys, because if I want to do an experiment that saw that coherence, I would have to do it on a time scale much shorter than decoherence occurs, but that's an incredibly short time scale. So So the way that this sort of state evolves under decoherence is to very quickly change, right? It goes from having off-diagonal elements to having none. So if, for example, I interpret this final state as these two terms here, I can do that. But this state of the apparatus is very fragile. So, you know, for a moment I could say, yes, it's in that state. But a moment later won't be in that state anymore, because the environment interacts with F plus and F minus very differently, becomes entangled with it, and destroys the coherence between those. So there's a really big difference between this decomposition and this decomposition in terms of how it evolves. In this decomposition, F plus is pretty stable. It doesn't become, you know, it doesn't become more entangled with the environment. Whereas here, this term here immediately becomes entangled with the environment. And so, for example, if I ask, you know, what would a measurement of F plus over time yield? In this case, I can imagine getting repeated results. You know, I'll consistently verify it's F plus. Whereas here, if I said, let's do a measurement onto the coherent superposition of F plus and F minus, in a very short period of time, I'll see that the coherence is lost. So in these kinds of branches, you have a lot of predictability, whereas in these kinds of branches, you have a lack of predictability. So that's a big difference. And there's a proposal by the proponents of the Everett interpretation that we should use decoherence to select a preferred basis. So things like the predictability of the states in the basis could be used to select one basis over another and say that, OK, we interpret what's going on in terms of this special preferred basis. Now, Adrian Kent wrote a criticism of the many worlds interpretation in 1990, commenting on a lot of work that had been done on it. And his point was that if you want a preferred basis, then you need to specify that as essentially an axiom of your theory or a postulate. You need to write down a mathematical algorithm that says this will yield the preferred basis for any quantum state. And so it's not enough to just say that, oh, you know, decoherence, you know, roughly picks out a preferred basis. Kent says, no, you need an algorithm. So if, for example, you want predictability to sort out the preferred basis, then your algorithm should be something like, give me a measure of predictability, find the decomposition which maximizes that measure, and then interpret relative to that. So there have been proposals of that flavor. They tend to go under the name of modal interpretations, which we haven't talked about in this course. But they essentially try to give an algorithm for finding a preferred basis. This predictability thing was proposed by Zurek. It's called the predictability sieve. There are other algorithms that say, take the quantum state, think about a partition of the universe into two subsystems, and then find the Schmidt decomposition with respect to that partition. The Schmidt decomposition, except in the case of degenerate eigenvalues, yields a unique decomposition of an entangled state. So people try to use that unique decomposition to pick out a preferred basis. So those kinds of approaches have had some success, but they're not completely satisfactory. And Kent was basically saying that the many worlds people, you know, cannot deny that such an axiom is needed. They need to settle on one and specify exactly what it is rigorously and mathematically. Yes?
Yeah, I don't understand why Kent is arguing that. It seems to me that that's something that comes out of naturally out of the coherence argument, right?
Well, you know, I told the story about how, you know, decoherence will tell you that, you know, which bases are going to be predictable, for example.
Right.
And Kent's just saying, okay, can you, you know, add some mathematics to that? Can you tell me, you know, what do you mean by predictability? What's the measure of predictability? What's an algorithm? You know, what is the preferred basis mathematically? Tell me precisely what it is, and then, you know, just give me a quantum state and I can calculate it. And I can calculate, you know, in which branches things are happening. That's this.
Yes. Shouldn't the basis just be dictated by the evolution of by the specific system, for example, measurement of the evolution?
Shouldn't the preferred basis be dictated by the system?
Yeah.
Which system?
Well, the system which observed the what you measure when we get down to it.
So I have, you know, a number of systems here, spin, apparatus, environment. They're in a particular overall quantum state, and it's just a mathematical fact that there are many ways of writing down that quantum state as a sum of terms. So I didn't say it explicitly, but if I interact with the environment and then I collapse onto these, or I decompose relative to this basis for the apparatus, f plus minus f minus, then the relative state of the rest of the stuff is an entangled state between the spin and the environment. If I consider the decomposition relative to the basis f plus f minus, it's just these two branches. So the question is, why should I interpret this overall quantum state as, you know, here's one world, here's another world, as opposed to this way, here's one world, here's another world. Those are two different ways of partitioning the quantum state into a set of worlds. And the question is, why should, you know, this is the interpretation we want. This is the one that corresponds to our experiences. Either you see spin up or you see spin down. This way of branching the world is very different. You know, either you are in some funny superposition of observing up and down, or some other funny superposition with the opposite phase. And so, you know, Kant says, look, the many worlds proponent has to tell us why we ought to interpret it according to this decomposition and not this one. So the nature of the, you know, what unitary was implemented doesn't solve this problem, because no matter what the unitary was, if it's a Z spin, if it's an X spin, whatever, it's always a mathematical fact that there are many ways of decomposing it. I've written two. There are, in fact, infinitely many ways of writing this wave function as a sum of terms. And the question is, what are the set of branches that we should interpret as being the different possible worlds? So any ideas on how to respond to Kant's criticism? How do you feel about it? Is it appropriate to ask for a mathematical algorithm for selecting branches? Yes.
So we have to reduce this selection rule. To me, that just sounds like a weaker version of the collapse question. So is that also okay? The results of measurements are relative to the observers, but the basis on which they are observed is still something that you have to artificially fix.
The many worlds proponents often respond to this by saying, you know, the beauty of our interpretation was that we didn't have to add anything to it. We don't want to satisfy this desiderata of, you know, specifying a postulate that tells us which basis to prefer. We'd really like to do without that, because they claim we're just going to interpret the formalism as it is, nothing extra. But Kent says, well, sorry, you know, you just can't get away with that, because the formalism doesn't tell you, you know, which branching structure you should use to interpret the wave function. That's Kant's claim, that, you know, you need to give me some reason to interpret this wave function as describing these two worlds as opposed to these two worlds. But you're quite right that what Kant is asking for is analogous to what you have in de Broglie-Bohm theory. The position of the particle basically picks out a set of branches as those branches that are spatially disjoint. So the important thing in de Broglie-Bohm was that you had all these parts of the wave function that were spatially disjoint, and then one was occupied and the other were empty. So Kant is asking for something like the criterion of spatial disjointness.
Do we have to say it's preferred, or can we say it's probabilistic? Again, like everything else we've talked about, right? It's all just probabilities. You don't necessarily have anything preferred, just something that's governed by a set of probabilities in different worlds.
So you mean that of all the choices of bases, there are sort of some that are more likely?
Not even necessarily, right? It's just equal probabilities. I'm not.
Sorry, say that again?
Or equal probabilities.
Equal probabilities.
Something.
Oh, I see. So
anything.
So maybe, well, that could be a problem. So if the proponent of Everett came back and said, oh, actually, both of these branching structures are acceptable as ways of interpreting what's going on in the world, and maybe, you know, they have equal probabilities of describing what's going on in the world, then the critic will say, ah, but only one of these corresponds to our experience. If the world branches into this and this, then yes, I grant that you've reproduced our experiences. But if the world branches this way, then how can you claim that you've reproduced my experiences? You know, in neither branch am I in an eigenstate of having definite beliefs. So in neither branch, you know, are you reproducing the experiences.
Well, let's say that's not the branch we're in, though, right? That was something with a different, with a probability that we didn't end up in. Like, if something's chosen by some measure, and that's the correct structure for a different world.
So you, I'm not quite sure what the proposal is. You're saying that there's a probability for ending up in any one of these four branches, for example.
Yeah.
So if there's a probability of ending up here, then why is it that the critic will say, why is it that we never have experiences corresponding to this kind of branch?
That's not where we've ended up.
So we just happen to have gotten lucky over time and always ended up in branches where we have definite experiences? Sort of an anthropic sort of argument?
Yeah.
That had we ever ended up here, then we wouldn't be here today having this discussion. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Beth? You know?
These two things are mathematically equivalent. So, perhaps it's just that we observe it in that particular, in the way in the top one, rather than in the method in the bottom one, because they're mathematically equivalent. So, not quite sure how to explain it.
Maybe you're saying something like, it ought to be that the set of experiences that correspond to a particular entangled state are not dictated by how you choose to decompose it, but somehow you should be able to pull them straight out of the properties of that state. So there should only be one set of experiences associated with that state. Is that the idea?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
A little hard. It was kind of
it is kind of weird. Yes. Oh, sorry, you weren't done. Yes?
I was thinking the environment is so much larger than our system, right?
Yes.
So what if I have, instead, not only I do a measurement, instead of seeing just up, but I have tiny modifications on my, like, say the arrow that tells me up, that they are not microscopically different, right? That they correspond to what I will see as a measurement. And if I do the the mainstream matrix on this state, and all the others, like if the spin is up and I observe the arrow doing something crazy, like telling me down or something different, all this, maybe the jet phase will, they cohere more faster, dissolve the abnormal elements. And, but I have, and this states that will give me up, somehow they cohere in some way to give me, they interfere coherently to give me, the spin is up and I don't see a superposition of states.
So I'm not sure, are you trying to propose a way of selecting one of these branching structures?
Yes, that's the way of selection of the first base. Maybe if we have a big enough environment, all of these other superposition states, there will be maybe the off diagonal, if I write in that base, it will be the off diagonal of my density matrix.
Right.
They will interfere in such a way
right.
that the structure will be different, so it won't actually see them.
So it is true that the evolution of the elements in this branching structure and the evolution of the elements in this branching structure are very different. So, you know, here F plus F minus will quickly become entangled with the environment, whereas here, you know, F plus will remain disentangled with the environment. And so that's a difference that, you know, you can say, well, that's what's going to help us select this basis and not this basis. But Kent says, okay, you know, that I'm happy to hear you out, but you need to give me an axiom. You need to tell me, you know, mathematically, what is it? What is the difference? Is if it's one of predictability, what's the measure of predictability? Over what scale of time does it have to be predictable? You know, you need to specify all that to select the basis.
But wouldn't those two systems be correlated? I mean, they could interact with together. Like if you look at the evolution of the system, they are not two isolated parts of the system.
Which two systems are you referring to? The apparatus and the environment?
The one in the bottom. If we look at the evolution of the system,
Of the, like the whole thing, the whole universe here, these three systems together.
These two.
Yes. Okay. So
the first one is the
this universe, this term here.
Zero. The second one is the universe and the state one. So if we look at the evolution,
yes,
will the zero map only to stuff with zero, and the one map only to stuff with one?
Well, I don't know exactly what you mean with stuff with zero and stuff with one. If you look at this state here, you know, on the system and environment, it's entangled between, you know, system up, environment being in a state corresponding to up, system down, environment in a state corresponding to down, together with the apparatus having a superposition of states corresponding to indicating up and indicating down. So there's no sense in which this term corresponds to indicating up or corresponds to indicating down. Well, it involves both.
I mean,
so
what's the
zero-ness and the one-ness that you're thinking of?
No, I mean, if we look at the time evolution of the system, or at the, if something else measure it, would we, could those two systems interfere?
Yes, interfere. Systems don't interfere. Terms, different terms of a wave function interfere. What systems can do is become entangled or remain in a product state. So maybe you're asking, do these systems become entangled? You know, this pair of systems and this system. And the answer is yes. Yeah, if I take just this term and I evolve it forward, I'll find that F plus and F minus interact differently with the environment and therefore become entangled with it quickly. Whereas if I take a term like this, then F plus remains in a product state with the environment. So that is a difference. And Kent is saying, I'm happy to hear you out on, you know, promoting that difference to some way of selecting a basis, but you need to give me an algorithm. Yes, so this is the last comment I'll take, yeah.
So could you though just say that every possible, like Heather was saying, that every possible combination is observable, but now you weigh them with like probabilities based on how long it would take them to decohere or something like that. So you never observe these because probability is basically zero. Branching into that.
Which probability are you talking about?
Like you said that the top state is quite stable, so the decoherence with the environment is quite.
Yeah, like a state like F plus is stable.
Whereas
a state like F plus plus F minus is not.
It's unstable.
Right.
So now you weight the probabilities of branching into these weird ones by, like, you know, how long it would take to decohere or something like that. And since that probability is very, very small, you never observe this.
Yep. Okay, so that's very similar to Zurek's predictability sieve. He tried to come up with a criterion like the one you're describing. You know, he was talking, you know, you could use, for example, the instantaneous rate at which this thing starts decohering and try to find a basis which remains as pure as possible, so decoheres as little as possible relative to this instantaneous rate. And if you go down that route, you end up in what I usually call modal interpretation. So it's actually more like de Broglie-Bohm in the sense that you have a criterion for the preferred basis. And most of the modern proponents of Everett want to resist that. So they want to say, you know, Kent's criticism is wrong. We don't need to provide this kind of rule. So let me explain what the modern response to this is. Actually, before I do that, there's one other problem I need to mention, which is called the transtemporal identity problem. So we've talked about, you know, the fact that it seems we need to specify a preferred basis. But another thing that you might want is a notion of how to connect basis elements at one time to basis elements at another time. So in Bohmian mechanics, for example, you have a notion of a preferred basis. It's picked out by position. But you also have a guidance equation, which gives you a notion of trajectory. It says that, you know, if your Bohmian position is x at time t1, then at the next time it's, you know, close to x. But, you know, it may have moved. And it can move continuously around. But there's no sense in which at, you know, one time it's x, that the next time is just drawn at random from psi squared x. There are trajectories. But if you say that, look, there's no preferred, well, even if you grant that there's a preferred basis, you still haven't said how the element of the basis, the preferred basis at one time, connects to an element of the preferred basis at the next time. You know, how do they match up? How do I draw trajectories across these bases? So a useful way of thinking about Everett is relative to the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. So the proponents of Everett want to say that unlike de Broglie-Bohm, There's no preferred basis. There are no trajectories. And finally, there's also no notion of the actual branch, like the occupied branch, and the others are empty branches. So de Broglie-Bohm would say, yeah, you know, one of these is telling me where the Bohmian particles. So one of them is actual, one position is actual, and the others are just possible positions that the particles could have been. And the Everettian wants to say, no, all these branches of the wave function are equally actual. They're all happening. It's not that some of them are possible and one of them is actual. The objective state of the universe includes all of them, and they're all equally real. None of them have any greater status than another. And position is not preferred. There's no preferred basis. And so there are no trajectories either. That's the idea. So John Bell, criticized Everett on these grounds. He said, if we do that, if we remove the notion of trajectory from pilot wave theories, you know, to get something closer to Everett, then we're left with a very strange theory. It, in a sense, it can reproduce our experiences, because at any given moment of time, you can say, well, you know, it does a great job at specifying that I should be sitting here having a memory of the past, as if the past were some continuous sequence of events. And Everett, without trajectories, will do that for you. However, it'll mean that we're actually radically deceived about the past. You know, that actually, if there are no trajectories, it could be that reality is jumping around in some crazy way. But at any given time, you have a memory that it was continuous. And so Bell says that that's just crazy, so I don't want to buy into Everett's program. I would much prefer to stick with a pilot wave theory.
Does Occam's
razor like speed? Well, yes. Some people have argued that it's too extravagant, Everett's theory. If, you know, having all these, every time there's some quantum event that splits the wave function, you know, you get a multiplication of worlds. So some people would say, yes, it's too extravagant, and that's why we should reject it. But Bell's criticism was a bit more specific. He was saying, it seems to imply radical skepticism about the past, and that's something that I'm not willing to accept. Okay. Yes?
Is there a model of how we can actually see this radical skepticism of the past? Or it's, so that, you know, I can be convinced that, yes, this is, I can reject it because, you know, this is not what we think.
I think it's a philosophical argument. I mean, you know, we could sit here and debate the merits of a picture of the world wherein we're radically deceived about the past, but I'm not sure we can really resolve the question by some experiment. You should really phone the philosophy department and see, tell them about this experiment. They'll be interested to hear it, I'm sure. Okay, so I've sort of set up the case that the critics make against Everett on the grounds of the preferred basis argument and the transtemporal identity argument. And now I'm going to give you the modern response to these criticisms. So this is my response is drawn primarily from the work of David Wallace. And what he says is that no axiom is needed for basis selection because real things, such as macroscopic objects and worlds, are emergent patterns. So first of all, he argues that inaccessibility does not warrant a claim that something's unreal. So you might say, oh, we have these other branches of the wave function. Observers in this branch can't access the other branches. Therefore, you know, why should they think that that's real? And he said, look, that's not so different from the fact that there are galaxies that are millions of light years away, and our best theories say they really exist. But in all likelihood, we'll never get there. You know, we will never have direct experience. Nothing that's going on there will ever influence us. And yet we don't think that because of that, suddenly they're unreal. They fit into our best theories, therefore we should admit that they're just as real as anything else. And Wallace argues, similarly with the other branches of the wave function. Our theory tells us they're there, we should admit that they're real. And he also says, look, this tendency to demand that for something to be real, it has to appear, say, in, you know, the axioms of my theory or in the fundamental ontology of my theory, that's also inappropriate. So, you know, there's lots of real things that are, you know, not particles in the standard model. There's lots of things we call real, even though we can't describe them completely precisely in terms of the standard model. So here's an example of something that everybody would grant is real, but is not in the axioms of our best physical theories, a tiger. So why do we think that tigers are real? The argument is that what the criterion for reality is that this should be some kind of a pattern which is useful, that's somehow coherent. So there are patterns that behave in certain ways. They essentially behave like tigers. And so it makes sense for us to assign some reality to these patterns. We call them tigers. Even though we have no explanation of the behavior of a tiger in terms of the fundamental ontology of our best theories. If, you know, far from it. You know, if we tried to have an explanation of a tiger in terms of particles, it would just be impossible. If we moved up to the level of cell biology and used the concepts of cell biology, which is very far from the concepts of particle physics, we would also have an impossible task. It's only when we move up to the level of, you know, evolutionary adaptation and you know, hunting behavior and predator-prey relations and camouflage that we can hope to have an explanation of the tiger's behavior. So the idea is that, you know, it's the possibility of explanations of things in the world. So we posit tigers because they help us explain things, and that's enough to grant reality to that entity. We don't need to reduce it to the basics. So to be a bit more formal, Wallace cites a criterion by the philosopher Daniel Dennett for reality. So he says a macro object is a pattern, and the existence of a pattern as a real thing depends on the usefulness, in particular the explanatory power and predictive reliability, of theories which admit that pattern in their ontology. So the key is the usefulness and predictive reliability of a particular pattern. So the Everettian wants to argue as follows. The branches that are picked out by decoherence do admit of patterns that have explanatory and predictive power. So the branches where, you know, the first set of branches we were talking about, in those branches, things are very predictable. In the other funny branching structure, decoherence meant that you had very little predictability. So the kinds of stories you can tell in that second branching structure aren't very coherent. You know, things are always unpredictable. Whereas in the first branching stories, there were some coherent stories. And you can get sort of a quasi-classical story of what's going on in the world induced by the branch in the branching structure picked out by decoherence. So it's not a very precise definition, the proponents of Everett would say. It's imprecise. You know, what is the appropriate branching structure? Well, you know, there's no algorithm to tell you what it is. But if you've got a branching structure that has some stories in it that are coherent and that help you explain the world, then you can assign reality to that branching structure and the entities that you find in it, because it's useful. Good. So maybe the last comment is that the fact that these patterns aren't precisely defined doesn't make them any less real, a proponent of Everett would say. So if you consider a mountain, you know, we usually think mountains are real, and yet we don't have a precise criterion of where the mountain ends and where the valley begins. And it's impossible to provide, you know, an absolute criterion. And that doesn't mean that the mountain's suddenly unreal. Similarly with the branching structure, they would say. Or another example that I like is species. So if you look at a species and you go backward along the evolutionary tree, it, you know, changes incrementally. And it just blends into something completely different. And there's no point at which you can say, you know, at this genetic mutation, the tiger was born, because there's just a continuous change. And nonetheless, we think that the concept of tiger is useful and tigers are real, even though we don't have a precise delineation of what they are. So, anyone happier with Everett at this point? Yes?
I don't think I understand
how the text is. OK. Well, this is a response to the charge that, you know, a precise criterion needs to be specified for, you know, which branches describe reality. You know, so how are we recovering our experiences in many worlds? Kent says, you need to give me a criterion for picking up a preferred basis and prove that that criterion yields stories consistent with our experiences. You know, the proponents of Everett say, no, we don't need to do that. That sort of notion carries along with it the idea that, you know, the only things that are real are encoded in the fundamental axioms of our best physical theories, like this axiom you're asking us for. But that's not true. Reality can emerge. It can be, there can be real things and stories about the world that are just emergent patterns. They're not precisely defined. They're not encoded there in the basic axioms of our theory, but they're no less real for it. And so we think that decoherence can pick out a preferred basis. It can recover our experiences, even though that preferred basis is not well defined and we haven't provided a mathematical criterion for it. Does that make it clear?
The patterns you said here, these are like artificial classifications we've imposed on a continuous spectrum of things like the mm-hmm. Earth and mm-hmm. geography or species, just
okay.
things that live in general.
Yes.
Are we doing the same thing, or is like the analogy hold with that? Are we saying there's a continuous?
That's what these guys are arguing, that if you look at the branching structure, you can't absolutely precisely say this is the decomposition of the wave function that yields quasi-classical stories about the universe. There will be many similar mathematical decompositions, all of which roughly will yield quasi-classical stories. But the fact that there's this vagueness in the choice doesn't mean that the interpretation is incoherent. I can still say that those quasi-classical stories have explanatory power, they have predictive power, and therefore we should assign them some reality. In the same way that we assign reality to concepts that aren't precisely defined all the time, like species, for example. So is anyone warming up to Everett at this stage, or?
Yeah, I'm
yes.
very warm about
it. You're very warm, okay.
But I just wanted to make one comment.
Yep.
The comment is that the picture is very similar to Borges's description in his short story, The Garden of Forking Paths. But Borges wrote that in 1940, where Everett proposes in 1957. So
it's
a comment.
Okay.
So it's striking. Analogy is very striking.
That's true. It's at the head of many papers on Everett, you'll find a quote from that Borges.
So it seems like the other decomposition is impossible. Or
well, these guys would say, look, there's a pattern there. It's just not a very useful pattern. It has no explanatory power. I can't really predict much about it. So, I can identify crazy patterns in the world that just aren't useful. So, I don't this object on Monday and this object on Tuesday, that's a new object now, but how's it useful in any explanation? I can create a category of things just at random that doesn't have any explanatory power. So. This second decomposition.
Yeah.
True. So they're not saying that it's because it was created at random that it's not interesting, but rather because it has no explanatory power, it's uninteresting.
But is it like an essential part of many worlds?
These other branching
yeah.
structures. It's not essential to recovering our experiences. It's in fact, it's a problem for the many worlds. And here they're saying, we can overcome that problem. We can reproduce the experiences by recognizing that we don't need mathematical criteria for identifying what's real. All we need are emergent patterns. Reality can be emergent. And so that's the notion of reality they're going to appeal to. So let's move on. The response to the transtemporal identity problem is just that if you have a similarity of a pattern across time, then you have a pragmatic, albeit imprecise, notion of world identity across time. And so although you may not have a notion of trajectories sitting in the axioms of your theory, you can still have a notion of continuity and no skepticism about the past because you have this pattern that sort of you can match up at different times. So much like many concepts, you could say, is this apple, you know, the same apple at the next time. Well, it's in the, you know, it's exchanging atom with its environment. So, you know, there's no precise way in which you might define the boundary between the apple and the rest of the universe, but there's still a pattern there that persists. Yes? True. So they would probably say, well, you know, if you change the circumstances too much, like maybe I vaporized the tiger, then maybe I'd be willing to admit that, you know, that the tiger's gone and that, you know, concept's not useful anymore. But there's lots of changes that could happen to the tiger. The tiger could run across the field. The tiger could get a haircut. And I would still say, you know, it's the same tiger, even though I don't have, you know, precisely the same physical object. I have a pattern that's persisting, and it still has explanatory power.
But if you're looking at a tiger at the zoo,
yeah,
then the pattern that you can see from the tiger is that it has stripes. But if a tiger is chasing in the wild, the pattern is like tiger's eating things. Does that change?
Yeah, I guess they would sort of resist the temptation to try to come up with a set of criteria that are kind of inherent to tigerness. Like, you know, having stripes is inherent to tigerness. But if you did that, then you'd say, oh, if I just paint out the stripes, then suddenly it's not a tiger? So they'd say, no, they, you know, what's useful about this pattern is something a bit different. And it's imprecise. You know, every attempt we make to try to make it precise might eventually fail. But we kind of, as long as it still has explanatory power, like the reason we think, you know, painting over the stripes doesn't change the fact that it's a tiger, that we know that it'll continue behaving like a tiger, and there's all these things that are going to remain unchanged. Okay, so I want to move on now to the second big problem with Everett, which is the problem with probabilities. So the first problem is called the incoherence problem, which is how can anything possibly be probability in this theory, given that it's deterministic. Right, it's just unitary evolution, the whole world evolves deterministically, and all possible outcomes occur. So there's nothing to be ignorant about, right? It's not like in De Broglie-Bohm, where one of those branches is occupied and the others are empty, and we can ask, what's the probability that this branch is occupied? All the branches exist, they're equally real, so there's nothing that is unknown. There's nothing to be picked out from the set. And so where could probabilities possibly arise? So let's consider a particular response to this problem, which isn't going to work. So suppose you have why not? Suppose you have a whole bunch of the same measurement being repeated. So I've got a bunch of different spin systems. They're all prepared in the same way, A plus plus B minus. I have four different apparatuses to measure them. I couple them all together, and they all go into that funny entangled state. Right? Everything is coherent. So I have four measurements of spin along the z-axis. So if I have, say, n of these measurements, then the branching structure of the universal wave function will look something like this, right? So it branches for, you know, the outcome of the first measurement. It branches for the outcome of the second. So now I have four branches, and then I have 8, and then I have 16, and so on. So the claim is that these different branches correspond to different subjective experiences. And now the attempt to try to make sense of probabilities that many people have proposed is that maybe what we do is we say, let's figure out which of these kinds of patterns are most common. So I've already said this. All branches are actual. So it's not as if we can interpret this in the sort of way that you might think. So the natural thing to do is say, let's talk about probability in terms of where I end up. Have I ended up on this branch or this branch? What's the probability of ending up on a branch with a particular number of frequencies? That kind of strategy doesn't work because you end up on all branches. It's not as if there's one of these branches that's picked out as, you know, the real one. They're all actual. You multiply into a number of versions of you, and you end up seeing everything, all possibilities. First criticism is, or first problem with probabilities, is a problem of confirmation. So in one of these branches, you see all pluses, right? So the theory claims that there's a branch with you seeing spin up all the time. And so the question is, you know, if in the world we saw spin up all the time, we would take that to be a disconfirmation of quantum theory by the usual way of thinking about it. And yet, why would Everett say that this is a disconfirmation of quantum theory if we saw that? His theory predicts that we'll see that. One of us will see that. So it shouldn't disconfirm the theory at all. So it seems like an odd position that, you know, the evidence that we take to disconfirm the usual theory doesn't disconfirm this interpretation of it. Yes?
Could you have like some compression, like Shannon-like, like similar outcomes collapsed?
There is something like that. Let me move on to that case. So this is a strategy that many people have proposed, where you take the limit that is n goes to infinity, and then you say, okay, because of the law of large numbers, all of these branches except a set of measures zero, the frequency of results will be the same. And then the strategy is this. You say, okay, then let's define a frequency operator and just ask, you know, is the quantum state an eigenstate of that frequency operator? And limit n goes to infinity, it will be. And then the eigenvalue of that frequency operator I interpret to be the probability of plus. So I just use a deterministic prediction of the theory, you know, which operators have well-defined eigenvalues, to get a probabilistic conclusion. So maybe that's what you had in mind. So my question is, what is the typical frequency in this case here? What do you guys think? So if I said, what is the typical frequency of plus if I did this an infinite number of times?
Half.
Okay. That's one possible answer. Any other answers? So a half is the right answer if you say, right, my measure over the branches is just a counting measure. So they all have, you know, equal weight, and I just count up how many of these branches have a half plus and a half minus. So in that case, you'll find, yeah, the typical frequency is a half. What's the other option that sort of jumps to mind? A squared, right, because at each one of these branches, there's this amplitude A and B for going plus and minus. And so if you said, oh, let's use the measure given by the Born rule, then you'd say, no, the typical frequency is A squared. So what this shows is that it's not as if you can derive probabilities from frequencies. So if this is a response that was given by Caves and Schock, if you look at the law of large numbers, you're not making inferences from frequencies to probabilities. But really, you've already got a notion of a measure. So you already have a notion of probability. And then the law of large numbers tells you something about the statistical properties of frequencies. So it says, for example, that in a set of measure one relative to your pre-existing probability measure, the frequency will be, you know, A squared. And so the point is that you've already had to interpret the coefficients here as providing a measure. It has to have a probabilistic role to play. You haven't derived that. And so you need to give a reason, the critics say to the proponents of Everett, for why we should interpret the Born weights as probabilities. You can't derive probability from frequency in this way. Okay, two other objections you can make here is, first of all, you need to reproduce the notion of probability not just for infinite sequences, but for finite sequences of measurements, because those are the ones that we use to confirm the theory. And then, secondly, you know, this whole idea of saying, oh, we're going to get the universal wave function in an eigenstate of some frequency operator is kind of ridiculous, because the universal wave function isn't even going to be in an eigenstate of me doing the measurement, because, you know, it's not even an eigenstate of the Earth coming to exist, right? There's some quantum event way back in time that bifurcated the universal wave function, and one of those branches, the Earth, exists, and another branch, it doesn't even exist. So there's no way in which I can talk about being in an eigenstate of having a particular sequence of outcomes. Okay, so that was the incoherence problem. The second problem is, what kind of argument can be given to justify the idea that it's these mod squared amplitudes which correspond to probability? So that was, you know, essentially the frequentist approach assumed that. And so that this is really what needs to be explained. And there's this new defense, relatively recent, a new flavor of defense for how to do that, which is quite different from the notion of, you know, you're on one of the branches with some probability. So it grants that, you know, every branch, there's a version of you. They're all equally actual. Instead, it says that we regain probabilities through decision theory. So decision theory, classical decision theory, is basically the theory that says how you should gamble and not be guaranteed to take a loss. So you assign a utility function, which tells you how much you value different outcomes. And then you assign probabilities to those different outcomes in such a way that you maximize your utility. So this is the kind of theory that would say, the probability of an event is the amount of money, let's say the probability is between 0 and 1. It's the amount of money you would pay for a ticket that will give you $1 if some event occurs. So if you're being rational, then you won't pay more money than the probability you assign for that event occurring. So you could just interpret probabilities in that way, in terms of your gambling behavior. It sort of codifies what a rational agent, how a rational agent will gamble. So I'm not going to go into the details of David Deutsch's argument, but roughly speaking, he says that the Born rule, Wade, and Everett plays the same role in weighting utilities in decision theory as probabilities do in one-world indeterministic theories. So an agent who's rational and who knows that the Born rule weight of an outcome is P is basically compelled by rationality to act as if that outcome had P, to act as if they were living in one world where things were happening indeterministically and the outcome had P. So that's the idea. The probabilities are recovered in this decision theoretic way. There are two responses to this. So this is a paper with many authors. Howard Barnum is the first author. And it argues quite convincingly, I think, that there's a hidden assumption in Deutsch's proof. And that hidden assumption essentially applies Laplace's principle of insufficient reason to, which is a principle that says, if you're indifferent between two things, then you should assign them similar probabilities. The same probability, I'm sorry. It applies that to a set of equal amplitude alternatives. So one of the steps in the proof says, if these two terms in the wave function have the same amplitude, then I should be indifferent to them. But that already acknowledges a priori that these amplitudes are related to probabilities. That's already granting that having equal amplitude means having equal probability. So the claim is that the argument has assumed what it set out to prove, and so it hasn't succeeded. The second criticism of the argument is due to David Albert, different in flavor. It says that even if the argument were to succeed, it's not enough. Because even if I could show that agents in living in an Everettian world bet in accordance with the Born rule, that's not what we really need to show. What we really need to show is that they'll observe particular relative frequencies when they do their experiments. So yes, they may bet in a certain way, but to see that Everett is a good interpretation, it ought to predict that when they go to the lab and they do some measurements, they're going to observe certain relative frequencies, not just explain why they bet in certain ways, but explain what they actually observe. That's Albert's claim. Okay, so I'm sorry I'm over time, so let me wrap up. So we've seen the criticisms of probability in Everett, the defense against the problems of the preferred basis. Let me get back to comparing de Broglie-Bohm with Everett. So first of all, on the question of Occam's razor, remember that in the de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory, there were these empty waves. But the universal wave function was taken to be real. And so proponents of Everett say, look, the Bohmians have the whole universal wave function. We have that. They have it. They claim that those empty waves are real. They can re-interfere. They can have dynamical effects. So the de Broglie-Bohm theory has everything Everett has plus more, plus these Bohmian particle positions. And so Occam's razor should prefer Everett to Bohm. They also point out, the proponents of Everett, that this additional structure that you add to de Broglie-Bohm is highly underdetermined by the observable data, and it spoils the Lorentz covariance of the theory, whereas Everett is Lorentz covariant, and there's no underdetermination. Third, they claim that if I want to recover macroscopic reality in the theory, it's enough to look at patterns in the wave function. I don't need to look at the configuration of a set of Bohmian particles. So in a philosopher's language, the macroscopic reality doesn't depend on the particle positions. It depends on the shape of the wave function. That's the claim of the Everettians. And so they would say, you know, if I look at a measurement device, you know, when it responds depends on exactly, you know, when the wave function of the particle impinges upon it. And it doesn't really depend on where the Bohmian particle's position is. All the Bohmian particle really does is pick out one of the branches. And the proponents of Everett say, we don't need to pick out a branch. So we don't need the Bohmian particles for anything. The Bohmians respond basically against this point that macroscopic phenomena depend on the configurations of the Bohmian particles. You know, that's what it means to be in a particular configuration. And as evidence in favor of that, they say, well, remember those non-equilibrium distributions we talked about? They made different predictions from quantum mechanics. So clearly, the properties of macroscopic objects should depend on those Bohmian positions, not on the wave function. Because if it depended on the wave function, then the wave function in those two theories, one with the equilibrium distribution, the other with the non-equilibrium distribution, is exactly the same. So how could there be differences in the prediction unless the properties of devices depended on the Bohmian particles? And then the proponents of Everett basically dispute that. So that's sort of where the argument lies there. And then finally, something that the proponents of de Broglie-Bohm can say is that, unlike Everett, there's clearly no problem with probabilities in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. And we just saw a minute ago how there's serious problems with probability in Everett. All right, so sorry to rush through the end, but let me end with one comment, which is, you know, we saw all these different strategies, minus this one. We never covered this one. We saw all these different strategies for trying to solve the measurement problem. There's an interesting categorization. Roughly speaking, the psi epistemic invariable models and quantum logic and quantum Bayesianism, which involve denying aspects of classical probability theory or classical logic, they have in common the fact that the quantum state is interpreted as describing something about what we know or how we reason about the world. And the rest of them, Everett, de Broglie-Bohm, collapse theories, take the view that the quantum state somehow describes reality. So there's this interesting dichotomy of approaches. And let me just leave you with a couple of thoughts about that. One, speaking of Borges, if you look at the space that the quantum state lives in, it's exponentially large. So if I have n qubits, I have a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. So the wave functions live in this exponentially large space. And that's kind of suggestive of a possibility space or a space of, you know, ways things could have been and therefore what I know about something. And there's this nice story by Borges, not the Garden of Forking Paths, but it's called The Library of Babel. And I highly recommend it. He describes this library that has every possible book in it. So, and he just describes it really nicely. He says there are books that are minor modifications of Moby Dick, and the part of the library that involves the minor modifications of Moby Dick is galaxies and galaxies, and, you know, it's just immense. So he sort of paints a picture of how, you know, we think the universe is large, but things that are exponentially large are large on a completely different scale. They're just so much more vast than the vastness of space. And so it seems to me that maybe that's a clue, that because Hilbert space is so large, we should think of it as a space of possibilities. But, there's always a but, some people, Max Tegmark among them, see some appeal in the idea that we have an exponentially large reality. And you can ask me about that later. And then I'll just leave you with this thought, which is that if indeed one of these psiontic approaches is the correct one, then they really need to explain why the analogy between quantum states and epistemic states that we saw in the second week works so well. And with that, I think I'll end. So thanks a lot.